House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 23rd, 2011. The first item, we're going to go out of order on the agenda. The first item on the agenda today will be to open a public hearing on House Bill 2274 and call Representative Gerard, please. Yes, and Council, if you could summarize the bill for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2274 permits certified peace officers from adjoining states to operate as peace officers in Oregon within 50 miles of shared border in response to another out-of-state officer's request or in an emergency.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, for the courtesy extended today. I'm Bill Gerard, State Representative of District 56, which is Southern Klamath County. With me today is the City Marshal, Brian Victor, who will speak in just a couple of moments. Last summer, City Marshal Bicknell, who is sitting with me at the table, asked me to look into creating some legislation that would allow the California Highway Patrol to enter into the state of Oregon while in pursuit. Our county no longer has 24-hour sheriff patrols. Our law enforcement is under siege financially. And as a result, we're seeing more and more drug traffickers, et cetera, using Highway 97, which comes right through Klamath County, and, of course, up the entire state of Oregon. We hate to see the bad guys keep outrunning us because they seem to know where our law enforcement is, and we don't know where they are. But that was the main reason for bringing this bill forth to you today. In rural Oregon, a state marshal and a policeman from Merrill, Oregon may be the only person left to do any kind of pursuit in our county. If he needs help, he has to go to California to get it. Klamath, and particularly Merrill, Oregon, is located just 20 miles north of the California border. That's where our police assistance comes from. And he will explain that more to you, but that's the reason for the bill, is to reinforce our present law enforcement that is available to us in our county. So with that, I will, with the co-chair's permission, turn it over to State Marshal Brian Bicknell.
Thank you, Representative. Please,
thank you. Thank you. Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker, thank you for letting me speak today.
You need to identify yourself for the record. If you
okay. My name is Brian Bicknell, and I am the City Marshal for the City of Merrill.
Thank you.
Where this bill came from primarily is that we have a four-county gang task force in our area, MODOC County, Siskiyou County out of California, Klamath County, and Lake County all participate in this gang task force. Our community, especially those along the border, which include Tule Lake, California, Newell, California, some of the other smaller communities that are really kind of unnamed, but communities nevertheless in California, and the Oregon side, Malin, Merrill, Klamath Falls, and such, we all work together daily. One of the problems that we have right now is that if during investigation or during an emergency situation, if I request backup, my closest backup to my particular city is 6 miles away, and it's Tule Lake, California. State of Oregon does not recognize a California police officer as a police officer. So they do not have any of the natural immunities and liability protection and such if they come to assist me. In real life practice, they're coming and helping me anyway because I have no other backup. Right now, the Klamath County Sheriff's Office, which would be empowered to back me up in situations, has only one 12-hour shift a day. Between 3 a.m. and 3 p.m., there is no deputies on patrol in Klamath County. I work alone. I am 15 miles away from Klamath Falls, 18 miles away from the city of Klamath Falls, the next Oregon Police Department, 10 miles away from Malin Police Department, which, like me, is a one-man police department. So we rely on our California partners in law enforcement. This is not just a Merrill problem or a Malin problem. This extends through Eastern Oregon, Northern Oregon, Northeast Oregon, where sheriff's offices have gone to the extent of deputizing cross-state police officers into their departments to try to help with the situation. But then we rely on the sheriffs and actually having to go out and physically deputize each individual person. Well, there's turnover in this business, and it isn't done on a daily basis and such. And so what we're asking for is that a police officer who has been trained and certified in a neighboring state be allowed in certain circumstances, and those circumstances are simple. Emergency situations, if they come across a crime while in Oregon, or at the request of an Oregon certified police officer, to be able to come in and assist us.
Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad we have three police officers up here to help me wade through this. It seems to make perfect sense to me, but you know, Representative, thanks for coming here today, and you touched on how your resources and your ability to provide these resources are, these services are under siege due to lack of money, and I'm going to harp on this again. It's all due to natural resources policies that have been going on for decades that have driven you into bankruptcy. There's nobody down there to tax except for people that can't find a job, and that's what's brought us here today. It's a clear reflection on the problem that you're suffering down there, and I just couldn't help myself but to get it on record. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So are there other states that allow this cross-state collaboration?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the bill that's before you is one that I took from California and reworded it to fit Oregon's needs. There is currently a bill in California. It doesn't recognize every police officer in their neighboring states, but state police officers from their neighboring states to be able to operate within 50 miles, basically the same bill, across the border in times of emergency or when requested or part of an investigation. All I did was reword this to allow for certified police officers, not just a state police agreement. But something interesting is that is in California. In Oregon, although there is an understanding, I don't know if it's written, we have searched all of Oregon's statutes that says California Highway Patrol can do the same in Oregon. Doesn't exist. When California Highway Patrol, and by the way, we have numerous California Highway Patrol officers who live in Klamath Falls and commute to California every day, drive through the city of Merrill, and they're in marked patrol cars with guns and badges, and they are not police officers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sheriff Bob Wolf and John Powell, please.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, before you representing Oregon's 36 county sheriffs, and with me is Sheriff Bob Wolf, Sheriff of Polk County. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're here simply to request a clarification that may need to go to Legislative Council concerning the draft of the bill. As the City Marshal just explained to you, the wording in this bill is very, very similar to a law in California. And what's being passed out to you is part of the California Penal Code, which demonstrates the wording of the California law. The major difference in the two laws, as the City Marshal pointed out, is that the California law only recognizes the Oregon State Police, does not recognize sheriff or other municipal police agencies. The sheriffs in counties adjoining other states most have mutual aid agreements or memorandums of understanding on how they will interact in the case of emergencies. And our only concern is that this bill, in its current form, wouldn't trump all of those. So that, for example, if House Bill 2274 passes, the California police agencies could come to Oregon, but Oregon, the only police agencies under this act that could respond would be the Oregon State Police under California law. So it may simply require an amendment that would continue to recognize mutual aid agreements that other agencies have with adjoining police departments. And that's our concern.
Thank you. Question, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there mutual aid agreements more restrictive or less restrictive than the proposed bill?
Chairs, they're very similar in that they point out they're restrictive, so that it usually requires a request to come in. And this, we appreciate the fact that House Bill 2274 requires contact with police agencies once a California agency would come in. We think that's very important. And the same would be with these mutual aid agreements. But in those, for the most part, they might be a little more restrictive in that it's usually by invitation that they would come in. But if as this bill says, if they saw an accident right at the border, they would most likely, under a mutual aid agreement, be able to take action but notify.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2274. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2896. Representative Kenner, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee. I'm Bill Kenner, State Representative from District 39, Oregon City, Canby area. Glad to be with you this morning. Appreciate this hearing. My remarks I'll try to make brief. Some of this comes, in a little background is perhaps helpful. This comes from my experience in campaigns, in particular two campaigns. In 2008, there were some outright false statements. And in working with an attorney, I found that my recourse was pretty limited because having the second most liberal freedom of speech clause in our state constitution, slander and libel, which are the normal courses for defamation, didn't really work well. And so then having that repeated again this last time along with some other people, I thought it was good to introduce a bill that created another avenue to get at this. I think that this bill creates a mechanism that allows some penalties and will discourage this kind of false statement conduct. It also provides for damages and in attorney's fees, which also helps those who are pursuing justice and also serves as a deterrent to those who might want to do the wrong thing. I think it helps in the message that we're hoping to send this session about putting some sunshine on this and encouraging us all to be careful and do better. It helps protect candidates and the public from lies and hopefully will serve as a disincentive to lying. I can go over it more specifically if you want, or that's kind of a generic overview.
That's great. The overview is fine for today.
Any questions?
Any questions of the panel? Thank you, Representative. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wan.
Thank you, Representative Kenner. I just wanted to thank you personally and on the record. In East Multnomah County, we've had three cycles in a row that have been horrible. Started in 2006, where over $1 million was spent in East Multnomah County, and in the most recent election in 2010, the editorial writers at the local Gresham Outlook were very unhappy with the way that the campaign was unfolding, and used some very strong language with regard to the consultants that were peddling those wares. And I think this is a step in the right direction, and I applaud you for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, people are fed up with the negative tone. They are fed up. I'm just echoing it. So thank you for bringing this up to attention.
And I think, thank you, Representative Hicks. Mr. Chair and Representative Hicks, I guess a couple of things. One is I think people are somewhat fed up, but I think we ought to be fed up about lies. And some of these are outright lies, and I appreciated the Oregonian going to PolitiFact and starting to expose some of these things. I don't suppose we can get rid of negative campaigns. They work, but we ought to be able to figure out that telling things that aren't true, claiming people support sales taxes that they don't do, that kind of thing, that conduct is clearly wrong. And I think maybe this will help serve as a deterrent, and I appreciate your time and hope you will consider moving it forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Nolan.
Although this isn't a question, may I add my voice to those who are calling on integrity and honesty and a focus on the really important issues before the public, the voters, the communities in Oregon. I join that sentiment very enthusiastically.
Thank you. Representative Nolan, I thank you for that. And frankly, the history of this is far from partisan. This is a bipartisan problem, and it is something that I think we can solve. And I think we need to. And I guess the thing that alarms me in this last campaign, upward to 200,000 voters were lied to. Lied to deliberately and maliciously. I think that's a public issue that we need to take very seriously and clean up our act. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, if we spent that much money talking about flexible land use for industry, water development, timber, agriculture, irrigating crops, digging gravel, mining gravel, we could actually maybe get some jobs in this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2896. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2439. Ms. Stigler and Michalowski.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 2439 increases damages for taking certain game mammals from $800 to $1,000, deems damages stated in ORS 496.705 as the value of the wildlife for purposes of certain crimes.
Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Judy Stigler for the record, just a plain old citizen. Anyway, this bill comes as a result of some of the action that we took last legislative session when we increased the threshold amount for a theft in the first degree. Historically, the value of game animals, certain game animals, has been tied to the theft statute so that when there's poaching that is done, when the state goes to pursue that on a value basis, they can assess a value and they can it's considered essentially a theft from the state coffers, that you're stealing natural resources from the state when you poach a game animal. So what happened was we raised the value for theft, but we forgot to go back and make any adjustments in areas like such as this. And this bill does two simple things. First of all, certain game animals that are not considered trophy animals or their specific value because of their rarity or something like that, it raises it to the $1,000 so that it can be a poaching of these animals can be considered theft one. And then secondly, it verifies that the intent is that the value ascribed to it in the game statutes is the value for prosecuting a theft of those particular animals. So it makes a specific change in the theft statutes as well.
Thank you.
And I would add there too, poaching is becoming a grave, grave problem in this state. Those representatives from some of the more rural districts can appreciate that a lot.
Please. Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Elijah Michalowski. I am a deputy district attorney with Lincoln County, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney Association, here simply to support the bill. We think it's a good common sense cleanup bill. We do see it as it's just cleaning up an inadvertent effect of raising the theft statutes. I'm not going to go back over. I think Ms. Stickler kind of covered the reasons pretty artfully, but I am available to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions from the committee? Representative Krieger.
You're getting into my bailiwick where I hate.
Yes, sir.
$1,000 for an elk on line 10, 11. They go down to 21. If it's got 6 points, it's $15,000. So that 1 point's worth $14,000. Is that right?
That's the existing statute. Yes, Co-Chair Krieger. Yes. And I might add here, this doesn't. I didn't endeavor with this legislation, with this bill, to get into any of the, you know, pre-existing valuations that beyond where I wanted to go with this particular piece of legislation.
A bull just wants to have 6 points.
I know. I know.
Representative Shaw. Mr. Chair.
Representative, how are you? I just wanted
Thank
to
you.
Point out that in 2003. I had a young aspiring lawyer as my legislative, future law student, that is, as my legislative assistant. And he went over to Willamette, got his law degree. Now he's practicing in Lincoln County. It's our good friend here, Elijah Michalowski. So
there you go.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. And I also served as time as a game warden in Oregon with the Oregon State Police. And it was my experience with poaching. People frequently say, well, I have to feed my family. They usually had a fairly new truck. They usually had a very expensive gun. And they usually had a case of beer in the car that they were drinking, so it was more about just going out and spotlighting the animal because it's an easy way to shoot them. And we appreciate your updating this law. Any further questions?
Close the public hearing on House Bill
2439.
Thank you.
I'm sure you have a work session on that one.
Yeah, we could have had a work session on that.
We didn't post it, though.
I got two people from 100 miles, or somebody else too.
This is the last bill.
Oh, this is
the next one.
Okay.
This one is
2892. Okay. Landowners. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2892. Call Scott Freshwaters, Michael Wolf Siegel, and Douglas Schmidt, please.
And if I may, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me a minute. I'm sorry. Mr. Wolf, Mr. Siegel, I'll call you later because we'll have the proponents go first, if that makes sense.
So you're up, Scott.
Yes.
Well,
Mr. Freshwaters, Mr. Schmidt,
and Dan Lindshield, please. Shine.
And if I may, chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2892 provides a process for landowners to locate and fix shared boundaries via written agreement.
Okay. You can go ahead and speak in any order. Please identify yourself for the record.
Real quick, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger. My name is Doug Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'm here just as Polk County Assessor, not in conjunction with the association. If I could defer, I think there's an amendment that may be proposed to this bill that might resolve some of the concern I have. I don't know if I would have a chance to address the committee after that, or if I should just go ahead and do it now.
You could address later if you'd like, but you could go ahead and do it now if you'd like and
okay.
Clarify, yeah.
Again, thank you for letting me come and speak before you today. My name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm here only as the Polk County Assessor, not as a representative of our association. I understand that boundary line agreements have been in use for some time, and House Bill 2892 is trying to replace them, to place them into law. In reviewing the bill, I and my staff had some concerns about what it intends to do. Is the boundary line agreement a document described in this bill supposed to convey title or ownership? Is it only an agreement as to use of the property in question? What will be surveyed, the whole property line, and will lien holders be notified? These are just a few of the concerns that I and my staff had. In talking with different surveyors, there was a disagreement as to what it was intended to do, whether it was supposed to transfer ownership or just identify a boundary line. It is my understanding that the courts have held that these types of agreements do not transfer title or ownership on the property. I've heard of a possible amendment to the bill that says the boundary line agreements documents does not convey ownership. If this is the intent of the bill, then I would agree with that. And I would just ask that there be wording in the bill that says that these agreements do not transfer ownership. And it would even be preferable if that wording was on the document itself, and that there be no conveyance language in the document. We have seen some of these come through that are titled boundary line agreements, but then in the body of the document it says that the people quit claim their interest in the property, which is a conveyance language, which means that it actually changes the legal description, the title on the property. So I believe that amendment is going to be proposed, and if that's the case, then I would agree with that. That's my testimony. I believe the amendment is coming, and I just wanted to be on record that we would support that, because I think it would clarify the bill for future processing in the assessor's offices. And again, thank you for allowing me to speak to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question about your testimony. Assuming you have two adjacent landowners that are in a bona fide dispute over the location of the boundary, and they come to a compromise in the form of a boundary line agreement, that dispute has never been adjudicated by a judge or a jury to determine where the true boundary line was or to interpret the two deeds that conveyed title to the adjacent landowners. So if they're coming to the table with their own boundary line agreement, wouldn't you have to include conveyance language in order to make sure that if they selected a boundary line then that was different from what a judge would ultimately adjudicate was the proper boundary, that you had a full ownership unencumbered for the two property owners?
Well, that's Representative Wan. That's part of the issue of some of the wording in here is not clear. If we go off of the history, and some of the people coming after me, and even these men, can probably testify better, but the courts have held that this type of document does not transfer that ownership interest. And so we just wanted it clarified in the bill that what's been going on in the past and now is being put into law, that's understood. Because if it is supposed to transfer ownership, there's avenues for that. They could do a lot line agreement where they swap property, but that requires a full survey of that property, which can be prohibitively expensive. And especially when the boundary line is in such dispute that there is no beginning or true identifiable beginning and end to that boundary line. So I guess it's just putting into wording in the bill what I understand the practice has been, and some of these other men may talk to that. I just wanted to try and get some wording that would clarify what the intent of this document was to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
Please. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, my name is Scott Freshwaters. I'm a professional land surveyor. I've been licensed since 1987. I surveyed Fort Deschutes County for 30 years, and I have my own practice, and I'm here representing Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. Now, most of us are landowners, and hopefully a boundary dispute or uncertainty will not arise between ourselves and our neighbor. However, if one does, the courts in Oregon have recognized the right of citizens to settle that dispute or uncertainty. What we are trying to accomplish by this legislation is the codifying of that right and producing a method whereby the agreement is made part of the local record. This will assure the populace at large and all posterity you'll be aware of that agreement. Furthermore, if this legislation passes, there will be no need for adjoining landowners to fix the disputed or uncertain line by spending up to tens of thousands of dollars in attorney fees and court costs. The Oregon appellate courts have specified that there are three conditions that must be met in order for one of these agreements to be perfected. And this has taken place since the late 1880s in this state. And I have a notebook in my briefcase. There are 13 cases specifically that I researched. But the conditions that the courts have said must be met are: there must be an initial uncertainty or dispute as to the true location of the boundary. That uncertainty must be resolved by an agreement, either express or implied, to recognize a particular line as the boundary. And the parties must evidence their agreement by their subsequent actions. And Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker, Representative Wand, to address this gentleman's question, in Ross versus DiLorenzo in 65 Oregon Appellate Court 568, the fact that the boundary, excuse me, I'm reading the wrong line, this doctrine, this is in Cascadia Lumber versus Oregon State Highway Commission. It's on the second page of my handout, the third paragraph. This doctrine does not violate the statute of frauds because the parties take title not from the agreement but from their deeds as interpreted by their agreement. So, in other words, there isn't a title transfer here. We're just fixing a line that already exists by this agreement that has taken place.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask a question so I am clear on what we're talking about here. So if Representative Hicks and I have a dispute over the line here, and I say it's over here, and he says it's here, and then we say, okay, we'll split it down the middle, and we agree on that, this was actually a piece of land, how would that be resolved without a survey? I mean, how could we say, well, we fix a line that goes from the big tree to the little tree or something? I mean, I would wonder how you put that down so that it would really work, so that when somebody buys the land and they go back and look at their what they think is their land survey, and they say, no, my line's really over here, and they say, well, Barker agreed before that we'd move the line. So how would that resolve? So that, I mean, obviously what we all want is a landowner to know what he owns and to have that right to that property.
Right. That's a tough question, but I'll attempt to answer that. Co-Chair Barker, if you two knew where the line was, you can't fix the boundary by a boundary line agreement. That is not permissible.
Okay.
If it's in dispute, you guys are arguing over it, or it's uncertain. For example, you have a deed that has some ambiguities in it, and your neighbor, Mr. Hicks here, if I may, hires a surveyor, and he comes to one solution, and you, Mr. Barker, hire a surveyor, and he interprets your deed differently. You may have two lines 10 feet or 20 feet apart. That's uncertain. You two gentlemen could then agree without taking it to the court system, spending tens of thousands of dollars if it went all the way to the appellate courts, agree that here is the line, we're agreeing to it here, fixing its location, going through our procedure in House Bill 2892, and it's done, and it's legal and binding upon you and your heirs and successors and assigns.
Okay, thank you. taking that answer, so a surveyor would actually, a professional would come out and set the real line then that we can both agree on.
Correct.
And it would be like, okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Please.
Thank you. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger. I'm Dan Lindscheid, Yamhill County surveyor, and I've been licensed since 1979. I've been with Yamhill County for 40 years this year. You have before you the proposed amendment has been drafted up, and I think it addresses the Polk County Assessor's concerns. Also, we wanted to make a, so that the burden is a little bit on the private surveyor, right up front, and you'll see that on the first part of that amendment, it makes it so that the private surveyor has a responsibility to ensure that the provisions, the requirements there, document the evidence of the disputed or the uncertain line. So if that evidence isn't presented on the face of that survey, it goes nowhere. It can't proceed. So I won't belabor some of the other things that have been said here. I think this is a uniform methodology to recording these documents statewide. I think it's a good thing. It's good for the citizens of the entire state. So if you have any questions, thank you very much for letting me testify.
Thank you. Representative Nolan.
Thank you. I don't know which of you can best answer this question. When we're talking about these boundary line disputes or then boundary line agreements that are currently entered into, which I hear you saying is based on case law, not on statute, what proportion of adjacent property does it tend to be? Are we talking about a foot or two? Are we talking about a quarter of an acre? Are we talking about dozens or hundreds of acres that are in this no man's land?
If I may, co-chairs and Representative Nolan, down in the Lapine area, there's the west half of a section that was divided up by a developer in the 1950s. And I've heard conflicting stories as to how the lines were marked, whether it was college students or a retired timber cruiser. Nobody knows for sure. But the possession lines are supposed to meet. Well, let me back up. The deeds specify an aliquot part of a section, which takes this 1 mile by 1 mile square and divides it into smaller squares or rectangles. And in one of those acre and a quarter parcels, if I was to go out and survey it according to the deed description, down near the southern southeast portion of that westerly half of the section, I would miss the possession, long-standing position possession lines by as much as 80 feet. I mean, I wish I would have had time to prepare an exhibit, but I did not. I wanted to have a nice little PowerPoint and projection and all that, and I just did not have time. I apologize. But you have the actual deed lines going through homes. But the possession lines have been there since maybe at most the 1950s. There are old fences out there that, again, are 80 feet from that deed line by a proper survey.
Or is there no follow-up?
Do any of you gentlemen have a sense of whether the areas in dispute are accelerating or growing as we go to more and more subdivisions, or are they diminishing as we get to, as the technology, GPS, I presume, is a big asset in this kind of delineation? Is that helping to narrow the number of problem areas until the point where maybe one could imagine that it goes away other than bad faith?
Co-chairs and Representative Nolan, I guess I would say that the use of these very powerful tools in this day and age, including the GIS Geographic Information System and the GPS. Those are tools that are used, and they can refine it down to 12 decimal places to the right, and they are very, very precise. But are they accurate? Therein lies part of the problem, the definition between is the line truly there, or we see a possession line that's over there 80 feet. And so this bill really, we would like to see that people shy away from their understanding of areas in terms of parcels, you know, closed polygons, and look at a line between adjoiners. And that line may have angle points in it, but that line is what's being disputed or is uncertain and is being resolved by the agreement. And therefore, we don't have a land, any kind of a land use decision being made by these.
Co-chairs and Representative Nolan, I believe that the ones that we have seen come through Polk County have not been in large discrepancies, but I do think that because of some changes in the past where you do not have to survey a partition plat that's over 10 acres, it can be an unsurveyed partition, I think that raises the concern that there may be more of these come about where the property line is not monumented. We haven't seen that yet, but I honestly don't think that there's going to be a lot of these, but I'm not sure that they're declining.
Representative Tomei.
I just want a definition for monumented. What does that mean?
Chair Barker and Representative Tomei. Monumented, there's a definition of a monument in ORS 209. Surveyor's law that talks about a permanent collection of it could be stones, it could be natural, it could be iron rods,
okay,
things of that nature. But normally in this day and age, we don't set stones for monuments anymore.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Panel, no further questions. Okay. Next, I call John Phillips, Fred Vanetta, and Chuck Pearson. You can go in any order, but please identify yourself for the record before you begin to speak.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips, and I'm with the Department of Revenue. We're not here to support or oppose the legislation. We just want to point out that because in the property tax system, the basic foundation is the tax lot, that we want to be sure that this legislation does not convey ownership or title. And so we're suggesting language that has been drafted and is going to be offered. And that was just the sum of my comments.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. I don't know whether you're co-chairs, Mr. Chairman,
right.
Members of the committee. My name is Chuck Pearson. I'm representing the Surveyors Division of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors. This is an attempt to codify something that has been in use in Oregon for a great number of years. This is nothing new. The problem that we've experienced is that the county clerks have a list of documents that they will record, and in some counties they will record boundary line agreements, in other counties they will not. In my experience, most of the boundary line agreements are the result of infill development, subdivisions coming in, long established fence lines, rose bushes, whatever. In some cases, they can be as much as 60 feet. We've had in-ground swimming pools 60 feet across a deed line that I could survey, but it's been there for a great number of years. And this is an attempt to just make one system in Oregon. It provides oversight by the county surveyor having to sign off and make sure that this is not a property line adjustment. That's a line between two people. I want to move it 5 feet so I can build a bigger garage on my property. That's an adjustment. This is a boundary line that has been in existence for usually a long, long time. fence lines that were built 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago. People had no idea where a section line was. They went out and they built a fence line and said, this looks good to us, and people have been conveying property to that fence line for years. And as Mr. Freshwaters said, if you apply a strict interpretation and measurement, then you will have lines going through the middle of houses, going through the middle of somebody's garden or rose bushes. This is just an attempt to make it simple, one system, statewide, and have some oversight. It does not convey property. It interprets the location of the deed, maybe in a slightly different place than somebody else will, but the two property owners agree to that position, and that's fixed forever. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Mr. Van Atta.
I'm Fred Van Atta with Professional Land Surveyor of Oregon. I will work with your staff to get these amendments drafted by legislative counsel and get them back to the committee.
Great. Thank you very much. Any further questions, this panel? Thank you, panel. Next call, Michael Wolf Siegel and Mr. Keita Benton. I guess. Okay. I'm sorry. So. Mr. Wolf Siegel?
I'm also on 29.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, the bills are only one digit apart, so it'd be easy to miss that. So, okay. Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, yeah. just very briefly, one of the things that one of the witnesses said I wanted to comment about, which is that, you know, typically this bill really promotes settlement of boundary line disputes, and there's no existing process, because if you look at a boundary line adjustment, that under the land use scheme is considered to be has to follow all the rules, leaving both parcels a certain minimum size or not larger than a maximum size and things like that. And so really a property line adjustment might in the ordinary course be the right way to resolve this, but that's not available because of other considerations. And so this boundary line dispute, when you really have a bona fide argument to resolve, is really the only way that is available. And if folks in the county recorder's office are refusing these documents, then that definitely is a problem we need to fix to promote settlement of disputes.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2892 and open the, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2982.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 2982 requires the Oregon Health Authority to deny medical marijuana registry identification cards to applicants convicted of felonies involving controlled substances, prohibits such persons from using such identification cards, requires OHA also to obtain criminal histories on persons in possession of medical marijuana registry identification cards, and requires OHA to revoke cards issued to those convicted of felonies involving controlled substances. It does come to us with a referral to subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay, and today we have a lot of people signed up to speak. I would ask that you try to keep your remarks brief. If somebody has already said what you want to say, I'd appreciate it if you would take a pass on your speech. We want to give everybody a chance to speak, but if we hear the same thing 10 times, it'll have no more effect than if we hear it once, well said. So I'd appreciate if you would take that into consideration. I'm going to call some people first who have come from over 100 miles. First two people, John Sajo and Cynthia Willis and Bob Wolf, please, for the first panel. And again, if you didn't hear me before, if you just want to identify yourself for the record before you begin to speak, you can choose the order.
Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is John Sajo. I'm the Director of Voter Power, a patient advocacy group, and the author of Measure 74 that was on the ballot in November. I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill. I think it's unfair I think it, like some of the other bills filed this session, would have the effect of recriminalizing patients, punishing people twice for perhaps crimes committed long ago, has the potential to cost the state millions of dollars, and I don't see that it serves any particular positive purpose addressing what many people consider abuses of the current program. I really don't understand why we would pass a law that says that if you got convicted of growing marijuana 20 or 30 years ago, you couldn't use marijuana as medicine now, but if you were a convicted murderer or a convicted rapist, you could get a card. So I think it's unfair on its face. I think it violates due process, may be unconstitutional, and would be a financial boondoggle that the state of Oregon could not afford right now. So speak against the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wolf.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and the committee, thank you for having us. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the process. I represent a group called the Oregon Marijuana Policy Initiative that's composed of 10 of the
Chair,
largest
patients. Didn't
patient.
Identify himself?
I'm sorry. Yeah, identify yourself, please.
Robert Wolf.
Thank you.
I'm here to represent a coalition of 10 patient and advocacy groups in the medical marijuana field, including Voter Power, Green Free, Pro Oregon, Oregon Normal, Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, Oregon Healthcare Consulting, the Human Collective, Institute for Cannabis Therapeutics, and a few others. And together we comprise tens of thousands of patients, members, and advocates for medical marijuana. We strongly oppose this bill as a major problem for medical marijuana program cardholders. Essentially, this bill would seek to punish citizens who have committed a past felony but have also served their time and are now sick and perhaps dying. It's a form of repunishment and recriminalization. We believe that it creates a large unfunded mandate. My back-of-the-envelope calculation is $7.5 million to conduct these background checks. I spoke with a member of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana today. Between the patients and the caregivers and the growers, we estimate at least 80,000 cardholders in the system now are with applications pending. That's a lot of work to have done and a lot of money that would be spent in the face of more pressing budget priorities. This bill is very punitive on patients that may have a drug felony in their past for a crime that wouldn't even be a felony in Oregon now or in the past. And so in that way, this is a very punitive bill. There's also a privacy issue for me. I don't believe the medical marijuana program has the resources to conduct 80,000 background checks. It seems quite likely we would have to farm out the list to law enforcement or a private agency, and that having that list in those hands would create a grave threat to the privacy of all the patients and other types of cardholders in the system. Right now they enjoy protection from that scrutiny unless they're under active investigation by law enforcement. On a broader level, I don't see the sense in taking people out of a system where they're filling out paperwork, paying fees into a self-funded system, and then kicking them out for whatever reason to go to the black market. We're not going to stop these people from seeking their medicine that they find effective and necessary. And it would be a much better deal to take the people that want to cooperate and follow whatever regulatory framework there is and work with them to address any concerns that this committee has. And that's a broad statement for the whole program, not just for this particular bill. The marijuana genie is out of the bottle, and we keep trying to build a better bottle. It's a better process, I think, to start talking to the genie and work something out. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Cynthia Townsley-Willis. I'm here from Patient Services in Medford, Oregon. I agree with the two gentlemen about the holding people responsible for what they may have done several years ago, 5 to 7 years ago. So I will not belabor that point. What I'm concerned about is all the measures that are coming up that we need to help guard the people in the program, meaning the caregivers and the providers. There is a difference between a caregiver and a provider. A provider could be someone who's going to be in a dispensary or in a co-op to help, but the provider is to grow for the patient. Probably half to three-quarters of the patients don't grow for themselves. They're not able to. They have to depend upon somebody else. And we need to be able to keep the caregivers and the providers separate. We do not need to have anything limited, like only 1 ounce of possession. I have pictures of what I've been going through with a prescription drug reaction since Thanksgiving. I'm finally looking normal. It was horrible. And if I had to worry about how am I going to make oil with only 1 ounce of medicine, I can't do that. You know, I know that a pound and a half seems like a lot. It's not when that is what you need to make oil to get you through the year, to make any kind of capsules or whatever. So please keep our limits the way they are. And we do not want any kind of a liquor store. A lot of us have chips. I have a 23-year chip, and I'm proud of it. And I don't want to go to a liquor store where there's derelicts out there at 5 o'clock at night. Don't want that. And I say that we should not have a limit on what we get for the consideration of our medicine. $50 a year is per ounce is totally unreasonable. It costs us a minimum of $120 just with electricity. No soil, no nutrients, no people are coming over to help, you know, having a little pizza party to thank people to help you. So please consider what you do with us. You said integrity and honesty earlier, and I believe that it, so long as we maintain that integrity and honesty, we'll all do fine and get through the black market and not have it. But it'll only happen through change, positive change. And thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for this panel? Thank you, panel. Next, I'll call Dan Kuser, who's come from over 100 miles, Douglas Hewer, and Todd Delato. And also, if you could keep testimony relevant to this particular bill. I know there's a lot of bills out there, and if they have hearings, you can address those concerns at that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Krieger and rest of the committee. My name is Todd Delato. I'm the director of a Cannabis Research Committee, which is a political action committee to encourage the research of cannabis and to also provide some research-based input onto legislative measures that involve cannabis. The reason we're here today with Bill 2982, in addition to the 20-some other medical marijuana bills that have been introduced, is because we've had about 80 years of cannabis law making, you know, driven by purely politics and reason that goes that has basically thrown science out the window, science and reason regarding cannabis. I've looked at this bill and tried to find any research that supports why kicking past felons off of the program would be a good thing for the state. I haven't been able to find anything. Whenever we contact law enforcement to ask them to back up the claims that they have made in testifying at hearings and etc., I just seem to get a response which is basically an estimate for the number of billable hours that we would need to pay them in order to do the research to come up with the citations for their testimony. So I see no research basis for this act. And researchers often take into consideration ethical considerations. So I must state that on an ethical consideration, if we were to pass a law that would deny medical treatment of a patient because they had a drug conviction prior, I think that's a really unethical way to continue to punish someone. And keep in mind the the rights that Oregon medical marijuana patients have to medically treat themselves with cannabis that they enjoy today were felonies 13 years ago. And many patients were so sick 13 years ago that it was better for them to risk being arrested and prosecuted than to continue suffering with their debilitating conditions. So especially for those patients, I would say it would be terribly unethical to continue to punish them. With this bill and with the 20-some other bills, if they ever get hearings, it's part of my great interest to see that our lawmaking decisions are reasonable and well-informed. And so I suggest taking this bill and any other cannabis bills and setting them aside to an interim committee that will take an unbiased scientific basis and look at the effects that marijuana has, the risks and benefits on individuals and our society, and determine the risks and benefits in an unbiased, subjective way, and then come at a future legislative session and shape Oregon's law to be consistent with those. So I certainly urge you to kill this bill and any other that are in the likes that may come before this committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Douglas Hoyer. I live in Newburgh, in Representative Thatcher's district. I am a Class A marijuana felon. I'm not for possession and not for growing and not for distributing, but for treating a family member. And because of that, then I've spent time in jail, lost my family and my job, and a lot of my property. So I'm urging you today about the cost associated with, not only does it hurt a state budget, the county budget that I live in Yamhill County is the largest portion of that goes for community or the police and stuff. So I just want to remind you the cost of this is not only for the budget, but as well as the families as well. There's a lot of families that have been torn up here in Oregon because of this.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Dan Kuzer.
I'm from Eugene, Oregon. The point I wanted to bring up is, and the thing that bothered me the most about this experience, and I've been coming up here for quite a few years trying to defend the medical marijuana program, the one that the residents of the state of Oregon voted for, and here I am in having to go on my own resources, very limited resources, to come up to Salem, to fight for this law, for the changes that are being, for the improvement. Well, this is an improvement. And it really bothers me that this thing is so stacked with law enforcement. I don't understand why in law enforcement are making the laws. Oh, what's wrong with this picture? Does anybody else see anything wrong with this picture? We have Representative Schaffler here that's talking about having a panel, half of which is law enforcement. We have ex-law enforcement members on this panel right here, right now. And the marijuana program, the medical marijuana program, is not filled with the abuse that law enforcement keeps talking about. The PowerPoint last year, or was it the session before last?
Try to keep to this bill today, please.
I'm just getting tired of the laws, and obviously law enforcement has a real problem with the medical marijuana program, and I'm saying, folks, it's here to stay, and we're here to fight to save it, so thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did sponsor some bills at the request of some people within the medical marijuana community, as a matter of fact, and there's no unity within the medical marijuana community either. But my whole thing over the last four sessions before this relating to medical marijuana was to not accommodate a medical marijuana user in the workplace. Now, I failed at that in the legislature, but our Supreme Court came right out and got rid of the ability, the mandate to accommodate a medical marijuana user in the workplace. That was my main goal. And, sir, with all due respect, I've never put a panel together. I do not know of what you speak. I've never had a panel put together of any kind. The half of which was law enforcement. So I don't know where you're getting your information, but I just want to set the record straight. That is inaccurate, but you've been misinformed by someone. But thank you for coming to your capital. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I apologize, Representative Salford. I was just understand I did have the wrong name. I apologize.
That's quite all right. I forgive you, and I accept your apology.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, panel, very much. Brad Higginson, Jennifer Alexander, Catherine Garnes.
Garris.
Okay. Got to go back to block printing, I guess, so I can read these. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and Krieger and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today because the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program is one of the programs within my office. And the authority and the program do not have a position on the policy implications of this bill. We would like to ask some clarifying questions if this bill is going to move forward. There are a number of things in the bill that are very clear to us. Clearly, the bill would want us to do a criminal background check on every applicant of a patient and deny a card to those people who did have a criminal history. We would also be required to look at all the current patients, do background checks on them, and again revoke their card permanently if indeed they are felons of a controlled substance criminal activity. What's unclear to us is, first, we already do background checks on the person responsible for the grow site, and background checks are required in this law for the patients. There's a third category of individual that we keep registrations on, and that is the caregiver, who's an optional person for the patient to have a system with the possibly growing and the administration of marijuana. So it's unclear to us whether those individuals were included under the background checks or not. The other thing is that there are different levels of background checks that can be done currently for person responsible for grow site. We do a LEDS check and check just for criminal activity in the state of Oregon. If the intent of this bill is to have a nationwide FBI criminal background check, that is something that we would like to know. And the other thing, and just a more minor point, is the fact that it talks about criminal activity around controlled substances. That is somewhat vague to us. I'm sure we could figure out language, but if there was something specific that you had in mind, we would appreciate clarification on that as well. And the one issue that did come up already today is the issue of fiscal impact, and there would be a fiscal impact with this bill. This bill has always been, this program has always been totally fee-supported, and my assumption was if there is additional fiscal impact that we would make up for that with increasing fees.
Thank you very much. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Higginson, so how many patients are there now that are registered to receive this medication?
Co-Chair Barker and Representative Tomei, right now there are somewhat over 50,000.
50,000?
Yeah, and I could get you the exact specifics. We update that every quarter. There's 40-some thousand that actually have received cards, and there's still a number of pending. So it's over 50,000 patients right now.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So how many new patients might you get a year requesting a card?
Co-Chair Barker and Representative Tomei, the question was how many new patients per year?
Per year might request a card. Just request, not necessarily get, but request a card?
Yeah, and those numbers have been going up steadily for the last several years. Most of the patients who are on the system renew on a yearly basis, but there are, I'd have to get the number, but there would be thousands of new patients every year.
Thousands?
Yeah.
Last follow-up, if I may. So do you have any sense on how much it would cost for each patient to do this kind of background check?
Tomei, I'd have to get you those numbers, and I don't have those with me today.
Okay, thank you. It does seem to imply it would be a large fiscal, doesn't it? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I've seen you before. I see you again. When this was, I support medical marijuana. I support people that need this. It helps them for various, afflictions, and I think that's a good thing with people that legitimately need it. And I'm not a doctor, and I'm not qualified to decide who does or doesn't. But if I remember right, the number of cards that were estimated when the people of this state voted this in was far fewer than 50,000. And I've heard anecdotally, and tell me if I'm wrong or not, if there's any truth to this, that there have been a physician or physicians who have lost their ability to practice medicine in the state because of them handing out too many medical marijuana cards that were questionable. Whether they, is there any truth to that anecdote that I hear?
Co-Chair Barker, Representative Schaffler. The first question again was, when we first estimated how many people. The first time we estimated, we estimated about 500 patients in the first year, and we were very close. It was about 600. We always assumed that there would be some growth in the program. However, we really didn't anticipate it was going to be this much. When you ask, though, people, what's the right number? I don't know what the right number is. Advocates would say we're way too low. Opponents would say we're way too high. And then the other question was.
I don't know what the right number is either. I'm not questioning anyone's card. If they have it, they need it. I'm glad they have their medicine. God bless them. The other one is I've heard anecdotally that there's been a physician or physicians who have lost their ability to have their ability to practice medicine in this state taken away from them for abusing their ability to hand out medical marijuana cards. Is that true or not, to your knowledge?
Right. Co-Chair Barker and Representative Schaffler, there is, to my knowledge, one physician who had his license taken away by the Oregon Medical Board for activities around his working with Oregon Medical Marijuana Program patients. It was not because he had too many patients. In fact, that is not something that the Oregon Medical Board would follow up an investigation on, simply having too many patients of any sort, because we've checked with the Oregon Medical Board about that. The issue with this one particular physician was the fact that he was the board felt practicing medicine in an inappropriate way. Part of the reason, my understanding, is because he was not keeping adequate medical records on what he was doing.
One more, please.
One more.
And how many medical marijuana cards did he hand out? Do you have any idea?
Co-Chair Barker and Representative Schaffer, again, I would have to go look, but at that point, as I remember, we were in the low thousands, and I believe that he had over half of the patients at that time. And it is interesting to note there are a handful of patients who do have thousands of patients in the medical marijuana program. The vast, vast, vast majority of physicians have a handful or fewer.
And Mr. Chair, I really... I don't need to have this bill, that's for sure. And I don't want to deny anyone their access to medicine. If they've served their time, if they need this medicine, they should have it. I got no problem with that. The problem is, what generates all this, in my opinion, is stories like that doctor who, in all likelihood, in my opinion, was abusing his ability to hand out these cards. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I would bet it is. And it's just getting a handle on, and I don't think we're ever going to get a handle on it, but it's those kind of stories that generate these kinds of bills, to be quite frank with you. Me, personally, I am done with medical marijuana. I've been in, this is my fifth session. I don't see any of these bills passing. We spend a lot of time and money on it. I'm just sick and tired. There is no unity within the medical marijuana community. So I don't see anything attacks. Anything that you may feel is attacking medical marijuana passing, and be quite frank with you, and I'm speaking to the whole crowd, I don't see anything passing that's going to benefit the medical marijuana community either. I'm finished with it, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you having the hearing. Thank you for indulging.
And Co-Chair Barker and Representative Schaffler, that was more of a comment than a question, but I figure I can comment too. And this session, I was hoping there were going to be no medical marijuana bills, and that has turned out not to be the case.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you. Dr. Higginson, I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. You said that there was about 50,000 cardholders from last time. I'm checking on your website, and you're up in the neighborhood of over 56,000 now. I find it interesting because when I started kind of watching what you were providing, about 3.5 years ago, you were at 8,000 card holders. Can you kind of explain why the increase right now, all of a sudden, over the last 3.5 years?
Right, and Co-Chair Barker and Representative Olson, you know, I don't know this for sure, and I think that the advocates would give you a lot of explanations, including it's just becoming more knowledgeable, that the more providers are interested in using this as an alternative. From my personal perspective, and really I don't have facts on this, there have been a real growth in advocacy groups that have set up clinics to help people get registration cards for medical marijuana. I personally believe that is one of the big factors, but I don't know that for sure.
You're aware of, because we've had communication back and forth, correspondence-wise anyways, what I think was not made known as a result of the intent of what the voters wanted through the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act back in the late 90s, that it opened the door for non-residents to come in and also apply for a card. Is your office doing anything to try to correct that?
Co-Chair Barker and Representative Olson, we don't have the authority to do that. You have the authority to do that, and I understand that there is a bill that would limit the applicants for a patient to be a resident of the state of Oregon. I think we've talked in the past that was always our assumption when the bill was first passed, and it wasn't until about a year ago with the particular case of the California resident that we were told that the way the bill was, that the way the law was written, that we could not deny someone just because they were not a Oregon resident.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I got to tell you, I'm frustrated with this whole thing because I felt that to some degree your office was somewhat keeping this under the cover to some degree as far as I'm concerned, and the response that I finally received from you, it was only upon your movement toward an opinion from the Attorney General's office regarding this whole issue to find out exactly if, in fact, that was the case. So I'm a little frustrated with what's going on. I clearly want to, Mr. Chair, protect the right of what the voters have voted here, just like what Representative Schaffler has mentioned. Those folks across the state that truly need this as a medicine, I'm there for. But I clearly think that there's some serious abuse going on right now.
Okay, thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Chair Barker, if I could respond to that, Representative Olson, and I'm not exactly sure what you were accusing the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program of either doing or not doing. I can assure you that what we try to do is to look at the law and apply the intent of what we believe is the law to the administration of this program. And sometimes those things change because of court decisions or other things, and we follow the court's direction. And that's what we're trying to do, is be good stewards of the program.
Okay. Thank you. Representative
Wong. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. What I haven't heard anyone address yet that I'm very interested in is a particular issue that has long concerned me about the medical marijuana program in Oregon, which is that we are in a situation with this medicine, unlike any others, where the patients that are using it provide it themselves. And as a policymaker, if I'm looking at a manufacturer of a drug or a medicine or a product, I hold that person to one standard. And if I'm looking at a consumer of a medicine or a drug, whether over-the-counter or otherwise, I use a completely different standard. But what I haven't heard from any of the folks opposing this bill is, how do we address the fact that the folks that are in need of this medicine are also the manufacturers and are also the people we have to worry about abusing the system, selling it on the black market for profit? That's the question that is concerning to me that I would like to have an answer to, if you don't mind.
And Co-Chair Barker and Representative Wand, I mean, I'm not sure I can answer that question. Those are issues that have been raised in a number of policy debates that I have heard. But right now, there is a law on the books in the state of Oregon that allows people to do those things. And until that's changed, I don't see how that issue is going to be resolved. I know that there are a number of bills that are trying to get to a state where there is more regulation and more controls on the production and the distribution, but currently we're not there yet.
Okay.
One follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Let me just tighten my question just a little bit. The testimony that I'm most interested in here today is why I should not take into consideration a prior felony arrest for substance crimes, which is the issue under this bill. Why should I ignore that when I'm presented with a person that is asking for the legal right to manufacture for their own use marijuana? I mean, that's the question that I'm really focusing in on. Why should I ignore that when they're going to be a licensed manufacturer in the future?
And Co-Chair Barker and Representative Warren, and I'm going to respectfully not answer that question, because I said as a start that, you know, we are not taking a policy issue, policy position on this issue, and I think that's a question you need to ask either opponents or supporters.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And anybody can address that if you don't mind. Thank you.
And we kind of went a bit astray because of Dr. Higginson's expertise and because of his position, but I'd still like to bring it back down to this today's bill, and thank you very much. Please go ahead.
My name is Jennifer Alexander. I'm testifying against the bill. If you don't mind, Mr. Chair Barker, could I quickly respond
to
the two of them?
Yes, you can.
I wanted to say that Representative Wand, patients aren't asking for the legal right. Voters gave it to them. They're asking to be bound by the same laws that govern the rest of the citizens in Oregon, and this bill would seek to have them held to a different standard, and that's where a lot of us have a problem. Voters said that all Oregonians had the right to this medicine, not just some of them, and so that would be the answer to that question, and I don't know that that satisfies you, but that would be why. And in answer to your question, Co-Chair Barker and Representative Schlockler, I understand your frustration with the lack of unity in our movement. However, I'm baffled by that, because we are a diverse community. We aren't one group. We are the entire state. We are old, young, disabled, veterans, anti-war. We're everybody. We are Oregon. There isn't unity. There's division. I'm sure on this panel you guys probably disagree on quite a few things, and you guys are only, what, 10 people? Hey, we're 56,000 people. So there's
God bless every one of you.
Thank you. I do also want to say, Rep. Schlockler, that I did speak with your office, and I was very happy with your more neutral stance, although you sound like you're kind of leaning away from it now. But I do respect your view, and I appreciate that more neutral stance. To get back onto my testimony, I want to say that I am very much opposed to this, and I will say for full disclosure, my husband is a convicted felon, and this affects my family. I am also a cardholder myself, and I wonder about the implications to me personally having a spouse that is a convicted felon. Would this create some sort of gray area that I would then have to worry about me being in a violation of a law when I have a perfect background? I don't even have a driving record, let alone a criminal background. We have children. I'm concerned about the safety of my children and what would happen if you guys take away this protection from my husband when, to be frank, he's an alcoholic that's recovered from this and he uses marijuana. And I understand there are some concerns about addictions, but I can tell you that him on marijuana is 500% better than him on alcohol. And I don't want to see him on pharmaceuticals. I don't want to see him on alcohol. I want him to have access to this medicine safely where I don't have to worry about my family being destroyed over a newly created crime that he would come under. In addition to that, I think that we need to kill this bill in the committee. I think that it only would prevent many potential patients from the protection granted to all Oregonians, as I was saying. It puts a huge financial and administrative burden on the already stressed state. We're looking at problems with our education, and I heard the police talking about the lack of funding. We don't need to put more burden on the state. I feel that it's contrary to the Constitution to exclude a certain select group, particularly felons who are convicted of controlled substance crimes, from accessing medical marijuana when voters granted all Oregonians this protection. I also think it'll create more criminals, not less. I understand the concerns about the abuse, but this will create more of that abuse, not less. I think it's cruel and unusual punishment to deny them an effective, safe medicine. I don't think that that's an acceptable way to deal with their past criminal behavior, particularly when they've gone through corrective and rehabilitative services and fulfilled their debt to society. They should be able to have all the rights of all other Oregonians. I think that there's a flaw that I almost hate to say because it's going to sound like I'm supporting something I'm not, but I'm baffled by the idea that we would prevent felons that were convicted of a controlled substance crime from having access to medical marijuana, but not thieves, not murderers, not batterers, not people guilty of assault. The people that I actually would be worried about hurting me to take my medicine, they're allowed to be in the program. Now, I'm not wanting anybody to be denied because, as I said, I kind of feel that that's unconstitutional. But if we're actually concerned with the problems in this program, I think those are the people we really need to be looking at, people willing to kill for something, not somebody who knows how to grow the plant that I need. I think, too, that... That because of that focus on the controlled substance and because this bill was introduced by the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office via Representative Winger, that this sort of shows the bias that we're facing against law enforcement with this. I totally agree that there are some abuses. There's some abuses for every program. But I think the solution here is not to keep throwing solutions such as this bill at it. I think it's to better track the problems that we're seeing. I would love to see conviction numbers, and I have called everybody and their brother, and nobody seems to know how many people have been convicted of these crimes. We only know how many people have been arrested. If all of them have been convicted, then I might agree that there's a problem. However, I'm under the impression, and pretty strongly, that a great majority of them were not convicted, and by listing the arrest, that hides the fact that there really isn't the abuses that they say. Further, the statistics that I was given when Douglas County said that there was extreme abuses was that 24 out of 72 investigations were OMMP related. 72 marijuana investigations for the entire year of 2009, they tell you 33% of them were out of compliance OMMP grows. You guys think, oh my God, 33% of 56,000. No, 33% of 72. 24 out of 1,600 patients. This problem is being bloated, and I understand that it's a concern that everybody has, but I think that we need to all step back and look at this rationally and find rational solutions. The problem is that we don't have a supply source that creates people filling that hole. I will be promoting legalization. I think that's the ultimate solution. In the meantime, I hope you guys look at rational solutions and reject anything that restricts our program further. That only is going to create more problems for us all. Thank you.
Once again, say we're running short of time. We're going to have to close the meeting at about 10 to 3 because people have to reach other meetings. I have a lot of people who would like to speak, so, but please.
Okay, my name is Catherine Garris. I am against this bill getting passed. I would like to represent the medical community and the fact that there's 3.5 million Oregonians in the state, and roughly 56,000 of them are OMMP patients. That is less than 1% of all Oregonians. This is a lot of ado for less than 1%. I believe that each and every single human being deserves proper medical attention. Humans by nature are not perfect and are prone to making mistakes. Some humans make legal mistakes and are, as a result, are convicted. Even felons, regardless of their charge, deserve the right to all fair medical treatments. No one should be restricted from applying for the OMMP or becoming an OMMP patient. No one in their right mind would restrict a felon with cancer from the benefits of chemotherapy, nor would anyone deny a felon of basic antibiotics, nor would anyone deny a felon the right to holistic healing, such as acupuncture or massage. Common sense should be that no one has the right to decide who or who should not have medical rights. Felons should have the same rights as any other Oregon residents in regards to the OMMP. Denying a person of medical cannabis is a great injustice and only leaves the option of harsh pharmaceuticals, the number one killer in America right now. Cannabis is proven to be much safer and less addictive than other pain medications. Anyone who has paid their debt to society should be treated fairly and not penalized. Every Oregonian eligible for the OMMP deserves the right to the benefits of medical cannabis, felon or not. Medical issues and medicines should be between doctor and patient, and no one should be discriminated against, and that clearly violates the right of confidentiality. Cannabis is medicine, and no one should be discriminated against or denied their basic human or medical rights. The OMMP has been around for over 12 years and has been a model for other states with very little abuse. We should be looking at expanding access for those currently excluded from the benefits of cannabis, not restricting it further. I urge looking at the numbers once again.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And because of the, I'll ask, unless the panel has a question they really need to ask, that we skip questions until we get more people to speak. Thank you very much, panel. And next I'll call Xavier Small, Bud Justice, and Jose Garcia, and ask if somebody's already said what you have to say. If you don't need to say it again, but you're, come on down. Yeah, me too. Please go ahead and identify yourself and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and respected members of the House. My name is Bud Justice. I consider myself a sovereign state citizen of the state of Oregon. gainfully self-employed for the last 20 years, and I'm here representing the Columbia River Care Providers Association, which is a most distinct facet of the Medical Marijuana Act approaching its 13th year. This act was written with a great deal of foresight by our elders. Prior to any formulation that becomes a law, you're talking about countless hours of deliberation and reason, and we must have had at least a decade of gatherings and public relation committees and so many voices to formulate the view that we have today. Fundamentally, the facet of cannabis is misunderstood. We are disorganized. We are not unified. We are a ragtag fleet. We've been under the thumb of prohibition for the last 20 years.
I can ask you, Daryl, we need to talk about today's
condensing the view is very difficult when time is money.
Yeah.
And time is money isn't so funny. Our fundamental purpose is self-care, wellness, and the integration of this measure, the holistic integration of the measure, which is being co-opted under the auspice of legalization and regulation. Big business is wanting in on the measure, and they want to find a piece of the pie. They want to find a way to covet the garden culture economy, which is stabilizing
Oregon's future. Today we're talking about
not allowing
convicted felons to be part of the program, so we need to keep it there.
The felon facet of the measure was written in and is very clear. If you have a felon that is within 5 years of your issuance of the card, then you are exempt as a patient. No, I'm sorry, you are exempt as a provider, which in this case would be the grower or being a caregiver. So you can still, from my understanding, be a patient if you're a felon. However, that safeguard is already stitched into the measure. And the measure stands. And now there's 28 or 29 more bills that want to dismantle and dismember the potential for us to recover from the collapse of what we call the corporatocracy, which is time is money. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Jose Garza. I'm fairly new to this, so I apologize for my lack of formalities.
No, you're fine.
Thank you for hearing me. I speak on behalf of some of the veterans. I spent a good portion of my life over in Iraq. I got to see things and do things that no human being should ever see or do. I came back a messed up individual. I committed a felony. I messed up. I have PTSD. I have severe pain every day. I'm serving for my country. If this law is passed, I know a lot of people in my position who have gone through the kind of things that I've gone through, seen the kind of things that I've seen, come back to society and have not been able to fit in properly. With my use of medical cannabis, I'm able to fit back into society properly. I'm able to handle my pain, and I know a lot of people in the same situation who, to be able to go to just a therapist and talk about what's going on in our heads, doesn't really work. Now, I don't know if anybody on this panel is veterans. I don't know about any of you guys. But I do know that if you are, you understand what I'm talking about. And if you're not, you got a family member who is. My main thing is if felonies are banned from the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, people in my position, people who have fought for their country, people who have taken bullets for their country, people who have given bullets for their country will be banned from using a drug that's non-addictive. I went through the opiates, I went through the Ritalins, the this and the that's. I got addicted real bad. I found medical cannabis. I was able to get off. I'm clean from all addictions. I don't drink. I don't take pills. I don't break the law. I grow for 5 million people. I don't charge them a penny. I give it to them for free. I eat the bill with the electricity. I eat the bill with the dirt. I eat the bill with everything. Because these people need this. That's all I got to say.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Hi, I'm Javier Small.
I'm a consultant to people who are interested in the program. I give a bi-monthly meeting in my town for the medical cannabis community, and I am a patient. I have another view of the abuse of the program.
Because of timeliness, we got a lot of people want to speak. We need to stick to today's bill, which has to do with not allowing somebody convicted of a felony to be.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, then I'll just sum it up to say that the police have other people to investigate other than sick and dying people in Oregon. And another thing I'd like to say then, is there a continuity, a community of the leukemia people? Is there a continuity of people who take aspirin and the police want to group them all together and investigate their illnesses? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm just trying to get as many people to speak as we can. Thank you very much, panel. Sarah Duff, Anthony Johnson, and Michael Siegel.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Sarah Duff. I am the Human Resources Director for Oregon Green Free, as well as Assistant Clinic Director, and I'm also on the board for the Institute for Cannabis Therapeutics. I'm here because I'm against House Bill 2982 or any bill that would unfairly punish patients whose doctors recommend marijuana to their patients. This bill would deny medicine to drug felons and no other medicine, and particularly there are a lot of other addictive medicines, no other medicine is denied to felons of any case. Once again, medical marijuana patients are being singled out for no reason. The courts have ruled that marijuana should be treated like other medicine, and yet, the courts have decided that that the part of the Medical Marijuana Act that says that that marijuana should be treated like other medicines, it should have said shall instead of should, and so now medical marijuana patients are discriminated against. There's no reason to do this. I don't think the voters really wanted that, and I think that the that this committee would be better served if they went with what the voters wanted, which was to allow this medicine for all patients. I work at a clinic, and so I could actually answer all of those questions that you all mentioned, but I will say that that everyone that comes to our clinic deserves this medicine. Yes, a lot of people look like me, and yes, I am a patient, and yes, I do believe I deserve it because it prevents my migraines, and you can look at me and decide whether or not I should have a medicine or not, but my doctor thinks I should, and I don't think anyone else should be making that judgment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Anthony Johnson. Chairs Barker, Krieger, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us out today. I come to speak against House Bill 2982. Like a lot of the people you heard from today, this is a cruel bill that really only punishes people and will cost our state millions of dollars during a current budget and economic crisis. And like Representative Schaffler, I would like to see no marijuana bills brought before this committee as well the rest of the session, because all the bills simply hurt patients and cost the state money. Example of Iraq or Afghanistan war vet coming back from war using medical cannabis for their PTSD, growing one plant in their closet could get a felony. 5 years from now, PTSD could be a qualifying condition, and because of that felony, you would now deny them from being a patient under this bill. I am the clinic director of Oregon Green Free, and so we certainly see a lot of patients who need this non-toxic medicine that helps improve their quality of life, as well as cut down on prescription drug use from very addictive, intoxicating drugs like Oxycontin, Percocets, and Vicodin. Oxycontin, Percocets, and Vicodin can also be sold on the black market, and yet you do not see a bill issued to deny felons the use from those drugs. The question came up about why the increase in the number of patients beyond what you expected of 400 and 500. And that is because this is a safe and effective drug that many people have used, and it's non-toxic, and it helps them get off prescription drugs that have damaging effects on them. And that knowledge of the effectiveness of the medicine has spread through medical studies, through the media, and through word of mouth. And so it's not because of abuse of the system. As far as the population of Oregon goes, many more people could become patients
and will become patients. And so I ask of you in this committee in this legislative session to not punish patients and think about the patients who will be affected as well as our budget that will be hurt by bills such as this. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Michael Wolf Siegel. I'd like to thank the chairpersons, the members of the committee, for allowing us to be heard. As near as I can tell, I'm the only person here today that this bill directly affects. I am a convicted felon. I pled guilty in federal court to manufacturing a controlled substance. That controlled substance was that I was growing marijuana. And I did a 73-month sentence to discharge my punishment, my debt to society, for having broken society's laws. Now, that was almost 20 years ago. It doesn't seem right that had my crime been murder, had my crime been rape, had my crime been arson, had my crime been a crime of violence against someone, my use and access to a medicine that allows me to use one-third to two-thirds less opioids for my chronic severe pain. And let me describe what I mean by chronic severe pain. Most mornings, in order to get out of bed, I don't get to just stand up. I have to roll out of bed and climb the side of the bed to stand up. In order to use enough opioids to treat my problem, I would be using enough opioids that I could not drive safely. I could not hold a job. I could not function. What you're proposing, or what, not what you're proposing, but what this bill proposes to do is to criminalize my access to a medicine that works. And I'm not going to pretend. I will tell you flat out, if you make it illegal for me to have it, I'm going to go get it illegally. Please don't recriminalize me, because that's what you're proposing. That's what this bill proposes to do. Now, I wrote this more better than and less emotionally than what I'm being, and I apologize for my passion. It's tough not to feel passionate when what we're talking about is whether or not you're going to be in pain. From a financial point of view, it doesn't make sense for the state. I guarantee it's going to cost at least $100 or more dollars per person that they do a criminal check to. You're talking in excess of $8 million. Is that going to come from the money that finances schools? Is that going to come from any of those places? No. It will come from those places. I'm sorry, like I say, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. This bill will set a truly horrible, horrible precedent. The decisions as to what should or should not be medicine belong in the hands of trained healthcare providers. They shouldn't be political footballs. You expressed some concern, Representative Wand, about people in my position abusing it. There are laws already existing. If a charge is made that I'm committing a criminal act, I'm subject to investigation for that criminal act. When it comes time, if I'm found guilty of that criminal act, the fact that I was abusing a legal program would enter into my pre-sentence investigation. A sentencing judge would take that as an exacerbating factor and would upwardly depart my sentence. The law already provides the remedies for the perceived abuses. The number of actual abuses. Representative Schaffler, you mentioned one doctor out of roughly 3,000 doctors who have now issued recommendations regarding cannabis. That's less than a third of 1%. How many doctors, I don't want to drag a red herring, I'll keep it very short. How many doctors have been debarred or whatever the correct term is, for sexual improprieties with patients? I guarantee it was more than one. It doesn't make sense to me. We shouldn't have to be here about something that like this.
Maybe we need a bill on that one.
I'm all for it.
Thank you.
And because we're running out of time, I would like to say that Greg Barton, Katie Dickerson, please don't come up. George Hayden, Christy Keurig, and Neil Feldman, and Larry Rathburn have all signed up in opposition to the bill, but because of time, I'm going to ask Andrea Meyer from the ACLU to come up and give her testimony, if she can, briefly.
I'll
be very brief.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make it very clear. Some of us have committee at 3 o'clock. We've run up against this time clock before. That's why we have to leave.
That's why we have to leave. We're not leaving because we don't want to hear what you had to say. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU, here today in opposition to House Bill 2982. I think you heard all the reasons we would set forth, and I know you've received a letter from OCDLA also expressing a lot of concerns regarding the date of conviction is unclear. It could go back to times when marijuana, even a small possession, was a felony. The issues around interfering with the patient and the doctor relationship, but I also think, Representative Wisner, I couldn't help think of you in terms of the fingerprint background checks and whether we wanted to explore the FBI role in that one again. So for all those reasons, and I'm around the building to answer any questions in the future, the ACLU would urge you not to move forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you. And, sir, we're just having one other person testify. We've run out of time, and I apologize. I read the names to put on the record who was here in opposition.
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you. And one. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. And Keith Benton and Michael Wolf are also here. Oh, we had him. And on Michael Benton, or I'm sorry, Keith Benton also is here in opposition. Have one person in favor. Mark Luca, please. I want to thank everybody for your patience. It's been a long meeting, and I'm sorry we couldn't have everybody heard, but we just are running out of time. So please go ahead.
Thank you, co-chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Luca, and I currently reside in Staten, Oregon. Just to clarify something that somebody said earlier, this bill is not sponsored by the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. It is sponsored by a private citizen who happens to work there with over 20 years in law enforcement. I have submitted written testimony, so I'll try to condense my testimony into just answering some of the concerns of folks that have been here earlier. Just also for the record, I have patrolled the districts of six of the members of this committee, and I've seen I have seen abuses of this program myself. One thing that I think we can all agree on is that when the voters passed this law, they didn't envision the degree of abuse that's occurring today, and they certainly would not have approved the acquisition of medical marijuana cards by people who have already shown a felonious disregard for the drug laws of the state of Oregon. Keep in mind, we're talking about drug felonies, manufacturing or possession of hard drugs, or manufacturing and distribution of marijuana.
I would like to remind the audience, please don't do that. Nobody spoke up while one side was testifying. We would like to see respect given to everybody. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just last week, the Special Investigations Unit of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office arrested two men for delivering a large amount, several pounds of marijuana, to an undercover agent. The person growing the marijuana had a license by the state to grow this marijuana. And if this bill does not pass upon his felony conviction, he'll still be able to possess up to an ounce of marijuana at a time. And for those unfamiliar, that's about a sandwich bag-sized marijuana. For somebody who has legitimate medical purposes, that's not a lot, but for somebody who is using it for illegitimate purposes, it certainly is. This bill's not a panacea, and obviously with the number of bills you have before you, this is not going to cure all the problems, and I'm glad you're looking into it. But it is going to perhaps take a step and start the conversation. There are some ways that the bill could be better, and one thing may be limited to just probationers, people who serve on probation, they can be limited from having a card. So that's something the state already can do, but it's just not done very often. In addition, perhaps law enforcement officials could have a form that they fill out if they suspect abuse, and it can be reviewed by somebody rather than this. But I don't want to get too far in the weeds as far as what could be done. I trust the committee to give the consideration of that going forward. A couple of the issues that were raised, one is the cost. Keep in mind, for concealed handgun licensees, it's a $50 cost, and it's borne by the applicant. If you can do a national background check for one person for $50, I'm sure it can be done for other crimes as well. Even using Mr. Wolf's numbers, I quickly figured it at $93.75, which when you consider the cost of getting marijuana illegally is a small price to pay. Somebody else brought up the idea that I believe from the Cannabis Research Organization that this was purely politics. Well, it's not politics for the people that are hurt by the abuse of the system. From people who are using this program and then going out and committing crimes to support their drug habit, it is not politics for the amount of schizophrenia cases that marijuana is documented to cause. And I hear laughter from the gallery, but there is a Swiss study that took in 60,000 participants in this study, and it was a very well documented case. Or by the other deleterious side effects. For example, K2 and others covered the case of James Lord, who was a medical marijuana cardholder who killed two people on Highway 99 at South End Road in Canby while under the influence of his medical marijuana. And he was sentenced to 10 years, and rightfully so. I would just say also, in terms of the unconstitutional argument, we prohibit felons from voting, which is covered in the 14th Amendment, and from owning guns, which is covered in the 2nd Amendment. So it is not a right anywhere in the Constitution to have marijuana. Finally, I just say that, you know, I'm fairly libertarian. I would like to see this decriminalized at some point, but that would happen when we are not responsible for our brother's mistakes. And at this point in our society, we are. We're responsible for the costs borne by this and the abuse of the system. I've had family members that have used medical marijuana for legitimate reasons. I'm not opposed to the program. I'm opposed to fraud and abuse in the program. If you and your judgment don't think this is going to solve that problem, then I know Deputy Burley, in his experience and me and mine, find another solution. But I trust that the committee can do that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you to the audience for your testimony. I appreciate it. Meeting adjourned.